Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 110 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Listen to us live every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on prn.fm, or download us after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast aggregators. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and including your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. If you would like me to speak at an event on viruses, on medical corruption, democracy, politics, or other subjects, I'd be happy to if your organization could just cover my expenses and a small honorarium. I am nowhere near as expensive as Hillary Clinton. Just drop me a line. And now let's talk about democracy, and following that, the tragedies in the world around us. Today I want to talk about electoral systems, and by this I mean who or what you vote for when you go to the polls, and how those votes are counted, and how they result in the election of people to electoral districts, to seats, however your parliament, your congress works in different countries. And I'm not going to have a guest because a few years ago I actually invented a new system for running elections, which has never been adopted and hasn't had a lot of attention, but I think it's actually better than any of the existing systems. So first I need to discuss what the existing systems are. The one that's probably best known is sometimes called first past the post. It's called this because it's kind of like a horse race. The first horse to cross the line wins, and everybody else loses. So in an electoral context, you divide your jurisdiction, a state, a province, a country, a county, a city, whatever it is, into districts, constituencies, ridings, some kinds of areas. Each district is associated with a seat. That could be more complicated cases where there's multiple seats, but usually it's a single seat. So in America, there's congressional districts, and each one has one congressman. In Canada, provincially, we tend to have what are called MLAs, members of the legislative assembly, and they are elected in constituencies or ridings, which are the same as districts. They're just an area which has a single seat. In our federal elections in Canada, and this is true in England as well, there are members of parliament. In Canada, the areas of land which elect one member of parliament are called electoral districts. But it doesn't really matter. Basically, there are pieces of turf. Each piece of turf has a single seat in the parliament. Everybody in that area votes for the same list of people. The one who gets the most votes goes to the parliament. So what's wrong with that system? Well, it can actually result in incredibly unfair results. I mean, imagine a situation, a multi-party system, such as there are in most countries in the world outside the United States or in dictatorships where an election is just a facade. Let's say that one party gets consistently 40% of the vote, and then the second most popular party gets consistently 30%, and then the remaining 30% go to a number of smaller parties. If it was the same in every area, the party that got 40% of the vote would get 100% of the seats. And although that's kind of a constrained example, there are some examples that come pretty close to this level of inequality. There was a famous election in Canada, I think it was in 1993, where there were really four major parties. One party convincingly won, I believe it was the Liberals, against a former Conservative government. The three other parties got almost the same amount of the vote across the country, which was actually quite interesting. One of them was the Parti Québécois, which ran in only one province. They want to separate from Canada, so they only run members in Quebec. They got almost every seat in Quebec, and they became the official opposition, which is basically a recognition of the number two party. The next party, the Reform Party, ran only in Western Canada, which was British Columbia, Alberta, Saskatchewan, probably Manitoba. Their votes were also concentrated, and so they came in third place. And then in fourth place, the Conservative Party, which had previously been the government, had their vote had dropped, but it was spread evenly across the country. And so although it was almost the same vote total as the Reform and Parti Québécois, they only received two seats, and there were lots of jokes about them having party meetings in phone booths and things like that. That was in the days where there still were phone booths on pretty much every street corner. And that is an example of the inequity that can occur. In Canada, it's quite common for the leading party to receive 40% of the vote and a majority of the seats, maybe 60 or 70% of the seats. Smaller parties that have their support evenly spread across the country, such as the Green Party, which probably has across the country 5 or 10% support, for a long time got zero seats, and now they have one or two seats. In full disclosure, I've been a member of the Green Party for a long time, so I guess I've got a conflict of interest here. I'd like to see them get maybe 5% of the seats, which in Canada would be somewhere around 15 seats versus the one or two seats that they have right now. These problems are less obvious in America, which has a two-party system. I wondered about that for a long time because America actually has multiple parties, but it has two parties. They're kind of institutionalized, the Democratic and Republican Party, and everybody else has to struggle. Any other party, in order to run a presidential candidate, has to be approved in 50 different states to be on the ballot. And so that kind of difficulty makes it very difficult. Election Debate Commission is owned by the Republican and Democratic parties, and so it's highly unlikely that a third-party candidate would ever get into the presidential election debates. The Federal Election Commission is pretty toothless, but it's completely ineffective because it has half its members are Democrats and half Republicans, which means that there's never a majority, and there's no tiebreaker, perhaps a member of the general public or a representative of a third party or something like that. But because of the two-party system, you usually end up with general presidential elections in America having maybe 48% for one candidate and 50% for the other. So it doesn't really look as unfair as it is. The problem is when there's only two parties to choose from, it's kind of a coin toss. And sometimes if you have a major issue, perhaps you're opposed to war, for example, and you realize that the Democrats and the Republicans both love war, it's pretty clear in this election that Hillary Clinton is more of a warmonger than Donald Trump, you really don't have a party to vote for. And you know that if you vote for a third party, you're never going to get your presidential candidate elected, so your vote's thrown away. Anyway, I don't really want to talk about all of those issues. It could also talk about the Electoral College and how presidential candidates are not voted for directly but voted through delegates and how this distorts votes and things like that. But the basic problem with First Past the Post is that it's done on a writing-by-writing basis. So if you get 40% of the vote in one writing, you will win the seat if nobody else gets more than 40%. And those votes, apart from the 40% that elected you, are essentially thrown away. So the complete opposite of that system is a system known as proportional representation. And in the pure form of proportional representation, everybody votes for a party, and then the parties get seats according to the percentage of the vote. Question is, who gets sent to Parliament in those cases? And it can be done with a party list. So the party publishes a list, and they number their candidates from their best candidate is number one. If there's 100 seats, they'd have 100 people on the list. And if they won all 100 seats, then the last guy would get elected. So if you're number 100 on the party list, the chances are you're never going to get elected. The problem with this is, of course, that there's no geographical representation. So there's not somebody who lives, or at least at one point lived, in your riding who is going to represent you. And so a lot of people dislike proportional representation because of the lack of a geographical association, because it gives parties, political parties, way more power. I mean, they have a lot of power in systems that use first-past-the-post, such as in the United States, where parties can choose superdelegates, unelected people who get to choose the presidential candidate. Also in Canada, parties are extremely strong. If you're a member of a party and you fall out of line on an important issue, they can throw you out of the party. And once you're thrown out of the party, you lose a lot of power. So there have been attempts to kind of vault together first past the post with proportional representation. And one way you could do this is you could elect half the seats, say geographical seats, and then you could look at all the wasted votes. So all the votes that didn't actually go to elect a candidate. So in the case where in one riding, one district, the leading party got 40% of their vote, those votes have been used up, but everybody else's votes would be thrown into the pile of votes that haven't yet been used, and those would be used to balance out the parliament. So that would mean, if it was done right, then the party that won 40% of the votes would get 40% of the seats. Some of those would be geographical, some of those would be added in from the party list. So that has the benefit of reducing the impact of the party list, but it's kind of an ugly, kludgy system. It's not terribly elegant, and it doesn't necessarily work all that well under all circumstances. Another system that's often talked about is a single transferable vote. And in this case, you actually vote a little bit differently. So what you could do in, say, an American context, you could go and vote first for the Libertarian presidential candidate, then for the Green, then for Donald Trump, then for Hillary Clinton, something like that. And so what they do is they add up all the votes for all the candidates, and then they throw away the one who's on the bottom. And for all of those votes, the second choice gets thrown into the mix. And they keep doing this until somebody has won 50%. This works reasonably well in something like a presidential candidate, which is truly winner-take-all. You only have one seat. It's not like there's a whole parliament. You're voting for the president of a country, so you only have one choice. And although it theoretically results in a majority approving a candidate, the problem with presidential systems, it doesn't really solve the basic problem with something like a presidential system, where you may end up with your third or fourth choice being selected. And so they could say that, you know, 60% of people approved to some level for the person who was elected president, but he might not be anybody's first choice. I mean, imagine if you were in Egypt in 2012 when you had the choice between Shafiq, who represented the old military dictatorship, or you had Morsi, who represented the Islamic Brotherhood. What if you were kind of socially liberal and you hated the dictatorship, but you also were very, very nervous of Islamic fundamentalists? You had nobody to vote for in that case. I mean, in a single transferable vote situation, you could have voted for somebody first, but then your second choice would have had to be one of these other people, and they were much more likely to get elected. In Austria recently, they had a case where the presidential election ended up being decided between a Green and, I guess, essentially a fascist. That's the kind of Hobson's choice you end up with in these kinds of systems. And it may be that a lot of people put down a particular choice holding their nose because they know that their first choice is not going to win. So now it's time to introduce my system, which is a little bit different. It is actually based on a computer technique known as cluster analysis, which is actually pretty simple. You basically need to start with what I'm going to call a hierarchy. What you do is create a hierarchy where the two neighboring areas where people vote are joined together. And so at the first level, you have half the number of seats with each seat joined with its neighbor. And then when you go up a level, you take that pair and another neighboring pair, and now you have four together. And you keep going up until you end up with one item, which is the root of the hierarchy. If you think of the mobile as upside down, think of it like a tree. The root has one element, and then if you go back down, it splits into two, into four, etc. This is known in computer speak as a binary tree. It's called binary because at every level, it either doubles if you're going one way or halves going the other way. Now, this system doesn't necessarily rely on a binary tree, especially if you have an odd number of seats. You may at some points have to join together three areas to get to the next level. Won't always be possible to do two, but for simplicity, we can think of it as a binary tree. Let's take a really simple example where you have five seats, A, B, C, D, E. So at the first level, you perhaps join together A and B. So you now have district, super district A, B. And then you join together C, D, E. As I said, you can't always do it in groups of two. So you now have at the second level A, B and C, D, E. And then at the third level, you join everything together. And of course, you can extend this as far down as you want. Now, there's only one important number in this system, and that's what I call the number of votes per seat. So if you take the total votes over the entire election and you divide by the total number of seats, then you have the number of votes that it takes to win one seat, which seems pretty simple. Now, one of the complexities is, since we're talking about votes, this means you have to have all votes in before you can definitively elect somebody. But then that's true of other systems as well. In the case of first past the post, if you've got a very close election, you've got to wait until the last vote is counted before you're absolutely sure that a certain person has been elected. So when you go to the polls in a system like this, you will have probably a list of people to vote for, of which you can choose one. And you have a party to vote for. Now, if you vote for somebody who is a member of the Conservative Party or the Liberal or the Green Party, then probably your party vote will represent that. But you have the choice. And basically, the bargain is that if your vote doesn't count for the person you vote for, it will count for the party that you choose. This is important because it allows independents to run. So an independent's not a member of a party, so they can put their name on the list, and you can vote for them, but you can also say, well, if my vote doesn't count because this independent is not elected, then I want my vote to go to a party. So then, in the writing, all the votes are added up, and we see if any candidate got enough votes to elect a particular seat. If that's not the case, let's say it's not the case at the first level, that nobody got a dominating number of votes, nobody got enough to elect a member to the Congress or the member to the Parliament, those votes go up to the second level. And at the second level, two or three voting areas are joined together. And again, we ask the same question. Did the total number of votes, in this case for a party, result in enough votes to elect one seat? So let's say that one party received enough votes for one seat, but there are two people who put their names on the ballot for that party, and people may have voted for those parties in different ways. They may not have done a straight party vote. They might not have voted for the Conservative candidate and the Conservative Party. So what we need to do is to decide which member of that party got the most votes. There's only two, so you can look at the total number of votes or the percentage of votes in the area in which they run. The candidate for that party that did the best would be elected. And so now we remove from the system that person who ran, and exactly the number of votes to elect one candidate. And in the case where the party votes are for multiple candidates, those votes are taken away from candidates in proportion to the party votes. What this means is that that member of parliament or that member of Congress or whatever would now be representing two voting districts. And so this is one of the unique features of the system, is that the geographical area represented by a member depends on how many votes they get. Now, at the next level, we bring together four voting areas, and maybe the second most popular party wins a seat at this level. Again, one person is given a seat in parliament, but in this case, they represent a geographical area that is twice as big. And as time goes on, the smaller parties will win seats, but they will win seats that cover a larger area. This means a few things. First of all, in every area, there will be a member of parliament or a member of Congress from every party which received enough votes for at least one seat. It could be, in some cases, a party receives only one vote over the entire jurisdiction, and that poor person has to represent everybody in the entire state or the entire country or the entire province. In other cases, more popular parties, their representatives will be more numerous and they will represent smaller areas. But it would mean that, for example, if there is an issue that you have concerns about and there are five parties that got people elected to the parliament, you could go to five different people who represent your geographical area. Some of them would represent perhaps a very small part of your city. Some would represent your entire city, and some would represent the city plus a lot of the surrounding area. And so the reward of being a more popular candidate is that you have essentially fewer constituents. You represent a smaller number of people so that you can theoretically do a better job. But this system would be much fairer than the current first-past-the-post system. It would be just as accurate at assigning seats in parliament based on the percentage of the vote as pure proportional representation, but it does it without the party list, which I consider kind of an odious idea that makes the party too popular. Now, what about independents? Because if an independent can only run in one riding, it may be very difficult for them to accumulate enough votes to get elected. So I think in this system, an independent could, if they wanted, put their name on the ballot in every part of the jurisdiction, so in the entire state or the entire province. That doesn't automatically mean they're going to get elected. They still would have to accumulate together thousands of votes. My experience in Canada with most independents, with very rare exceptions, is that an independent gets maybe 100 votes in a particular area. And in order to get elected to parliament, they would probably have to accumulate 10 or 20,000 votes. And so just putting your name on the entire jurisdiction would not ensure that that was the case. You would actually have to get the right number of votes. This system is obviously a lot fairer for small parties. If a small party gets 5% of the vote, they should get 5% of the seats. Their candidates, once they become members of the parliament, would have to work a lot harder because they're representing a much larger geographical area. But that problem gets solved if they become more popular. If they do a really good job in their position as a member of Congress or a member of parliament or a member of the legislative assembly, their party at the next election presumably will get more votes, and then the geographical area they have to cover becomes smaller. So there are rewards to becoming, you know, getting your foot in the door by getting the number of seats you deserve. And then if you do a good job, people want to vote for you more and you get more seats into the future. Another unique characteristic of this system is that when two areas are joined together, either the basic areas in which votes are counted or at higher levels of the hierarchy, if the choice of the actual person to sit in Parliament is based on the number of votes that they received, then if there's a high turnout, they're more likely to get elected. So let's say that you take two districts you're going to put together. In one district, 80% of people voted, and in the other district, 40% of people voted. Well, then the candidates in the area where there are more voters, more voter turnout, are more likely to get elected. Let's take a really extreme example so that you have a situation where in the north of a state, nobody votes, and in the south of the state, everybody votes. So at the point in the hierarchy where you join together north and south, all of the members of parliament will be chosen from the south where people turned out to vote, and nobody from the north. Now that's a pretty extreme example. It doesn't usually vary that much, but you could have a situation where in some cases 40% of people vote, and in other cases 80% vote, and there will be more representatives taken from that area. Another way to promote a particular person to a seat in parliament is to do it based on the percentage of the vote that they received, and then this is independent of the voter turnout. The problem with doing it based on voter turnout is if people get rewarded for a higher voter turnout, that could even further demoralize the people who aren't turning out to vote, who don't have representatives in parliament, people that they know, and therefore they vote even less. So doing it based on a percentage of the vote might be better. So if in one place, in one district, the voting turnout is 40%, that person would only have to get half the absolute number of votes to be equivalent of somebody in the other area where 80% voted. It might actually encourage people to get out and vote. Of course, if everybody gets out of vote to vote and the turnout becomes 100%, then it doesn't really matter how you count the votes and how you decide who gets promoted. So again, you've got the situation where you join together two areas. One party has enough of votes to elect a person. The question is, which person do you choose? And of course, as you go up higher, the number of people you have to choose from could increase. Of course, when somebody's elected, they get removed from the poll. So if you join together four ridings, but a particular party has already elected one person, then there's only actually three people left over at that area. If you elect somebody at that level, then there's now two people to get promoted up to the next level, which has eight ridings or electoral districts. Small parties get rewarded in this, but only in a very fair way. Because basically, if a small party has 5% support around a particular jurisdiction, they will get approximately 5% of the seats. It's possible that a small party could decide that since they've got 5% support, they're only going to run candidates, half the number of candidates as a major party, in which case their candidates would show up on two ballots. The downside of doing this is if they run too few people, they could end up with the situation where there's nobody to send to parliament because all of their candidates have been elected. But if you currently have 5% support and you run candidates in 50% or you run candidates equivalent to 50% of the seats, you're unlikely to see your vote go from 5% to over 50%. So it shouldn't really matter, but if you game the system too much, you could end up with a situation where you can't elect anybody because you don't have anybody left over. And there would need to be a system to handle that. One way is to allow a party list, which I don't really think is a good idea, because you could have a party that says, I'm going to only run one candidate and everybody else will come from my party list, which I think would defeat the whole purpose. Or you could just give the seat to other parties, which I think would be a fair system. If a party really did go from 5% to 50% of the vote in one election, which has occurred in some rare occasions, then presumably at the next election they would have learned their lesson and they would run as many candidates as there are seats. Or if they don't do a very good job, their percentage of the vote would drop down again. Another advantage of the system comes with redistricting. because the system is basically immune from gerrymandering. It doesn't matter how complicated you make the writings. The basic fact is that if 10% of people vote Libertarian, 5% vote Green, you know, 20% vote Democrat or Liberal, and however many percent vote Conservative or Republican, the number of seats you get in the end is going to be equivalent to the proportion of the popular vote. So you can redistrict all you want, and you can create areas that are richer, more white, or whatever you think is going to get you more likely to be elected. But it's not going to increase the number of seats over the entire jurisdiction. You could use it to try to elect your more favorite candidates, but then you do that at the expense of your own candidates in other areas, because no matter what you do with redistricting, if you have 40% of the vote, you're going to get 40% of the seats. Redistricting is not going to increase the percentage of your seats in Parliament, so it's kind of a useless exercise, which hopefully would result in geographical areas that made more sense rather than areas that have been carefully designed by the party in power to try to maximize their ability to stay in power. A couple of special considerations are that, especially in a place like Canada, there are some areas that are geographically so large that using a system like this would mean that there would not be a member of parliament who came from anywhere near where these people lived. And so my suggestion there is to just carve out low density, large area ridings and start with them outside the system. So they would be guaranteed a member elected off the first ballot. But the way to make sure that this doesn't disrupt the proportional representation is that the person elected would probably be elected with less votes than they should have. And so the difference between the votes they should have had to win a seat and the votes they actually got, let's say that's 5,000 votes, negative 5,000 would be sent up for the party. So in other words, the party which won that seat would lose votes at the next level. And this would ensure that the proportional nature of the system remains. Another problem is with special elections. You could have a member of the legislature die, resign, for whatever reason, has to leave their seat. How do you hold a by-election in a first-past-the-post system? It basically means that the same people who went, the same area that went out to vote before goes out and votes again. There's a new slate of candidates. You pick a new candidate, and that becomes the member of parliament. So in this case, you know exactly the geographical area in which a person was elected to parliament. It could have been one voting district, two voting districts, four, five, eight, 16. And so those people would go out in order to re-elect a candidate. Now, in the worst case, let's say that you had the Green Party had enough votes to just elect one member over the entire state, and that party member dies either of their own, through illness, they're assassinated, get hit by a car, whatever, they're gone. They resigned in shame because they got caught with their hand in the cookie jar. What do you do in that case? Well, there would be nothing for it but that everybody would have to go out and vote in this by-election to replace a member in exactly the same geographical district as they represent. In many cases, these votes could be combined with other times people have to go out to vote so that the cost would not be exorbitant. Well, that's a description of my system called geographical proportional representation. And I'm going to put a link in the show notes to some documents that I've written about this. And if any of you are interested in it, there are a lot of parts of the world that are considering alternative voting systems. I'd be happy to talk to you about how it would work and answer any questions you have. And if you read some of my documents and you see some flaws in the system, I would certainly be very interested in hearing from you about your ideas and your suggestions. And if you just don't think it would work at all, I'm also interested in that. I do appreciate everybody who writes to me about the shows that I have, whether they agree with me or not. And I think I learn a lot from the criticisms, probably more from the criticisms than from the praise. But if you do like what you hear, don't forget to tell me, because I do. It does make me feel good when people tell me that the show is great. Now let's talk about the news. It's been a bad couple of weeks in terms of violence in the world. It started with the police shootings of Philando Castile in Falcon Heights, Minnesota, and just before that, Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge. Now, one thing that was really interesting and ironic about this was not that it was black men killed by the police, that's unfortunate, fairly common occurrence, but that they were both legal gun owners and that the presence of a gun might have contributed to their deaths. I think it's true that some policemen believe the myths about the dangerousness of black men and are fearful of them. And when they found out that both these black men had guns, they panicked and killed them because of that. So what we can say for sure is that owning a gun did not keep Philando Castile and Alton Sterling safe, and it may have done the very opposite. Another tragic situation was the shooting of and killing of five policemen in Dallas, the injuring of several more, and also including some members of the demonstration, the peaceful demonstration that was occurring at the time of the shooting, and three policemen in Baton Rouge. This again seems to show that guns don't keep people safe. It's often said that what America needs is more good guys with guns, but there were two classes of good guys with guns at this parade. There were people participating in the peaceful demonstration who were open carry activists. I read that there were about 20 of these people. And when the shooting happened, the police, I can't blame the police, looked upon these people with suspicion. They didn't know if one of those 20 open carry activists had started shooting. The only thing that turns a good guy with a gun into a bad guy with a gun is when they start shooting at people. Up to that point, in an open carry state, they're treated as if they're a good guy. So it may have confused the police. But even the police, which were acting as good guys with guns, they were doing their job, they were protecting people who were peacefully protesting, were pretty helpless when there was a man with a gun who was moving around, so it was very difficult for them to target him. And so the man with the gun had the advantage over a much larger number of good guys with guns. It's very difficult to shoot at a moving guy in a dark area. The police did eventually kill him with a robot with a bomb, which concerned some people about using machines to kill people. But I think the point is that despite all of the good guys with guns, it was still too late for five policemen before they managed to get him, and more than five because there were also some who were quite severely injured. What could have changed this? Well, if this disturbed man had not been able to get a powerful gun with large amounts of ammunition and probably large magazines to load the guns, he wouldn't have been able to do so much damage. The same kind of thing happened in Baton Rouge. A disturbed man who, judging by YouTube videos and other things that he's left behind, did want to kill policemen. And he succeeded in killing three Baton Rouge policemen, which is, of course, only going to increase the tensions in the city of Baton Rouge, which is where Alton Sterling was killed. And you have people demonstrating against the police, but now some of those people are demonstrating but saying, we didn't want police to be killed. Is this two sides? Are you either for Black Lives Matter and against the police, or are you for the police and against Black Lives Matter? Somebody told me that we really shouldn't be too concerned about black men getting killed by police because it's such a small number compared to the U.S. population, a few hundred a year versus 300 million or some odd Americans in total. But it's more than black men who were ever lynched. And so if the number of black men killed by police is insignificant, then you have to say that lynching was insignificant. You could also look at terrorist events like happened in Nice or other places. 80 people are killed. Well, that's pretty small compared to the number of people who die from heart disease, cancer, traffic accidents, things like that. So you could say that Nice is an unimportant event because it was only 80 people. But I don't really think that's true. Some of these events can terrorize entire populations, and I think there's a lot of fear amongst black men when it comes to interactions with the police. And really, the police can't do their job if entire communities are fearful of them. And so I think really both sides need to come together and work together and try to eliminate racism and prejudice and profiling from the police force, while ensuring that we have a police force that does serve and does protect us. Another interesting irony of both the Dallas and Baton Rouge police shootings, by that I mean shootings of the police, the 5 in Dallas and the 3 in Baton Rouge, was that both the people who initiated these shootings were not just black men, but they were trained in the military. And I think America has probably a larger proportion of people who are militarily trained than almost every other country. And basically the state is training these people to kill and then bringing them back home again and saying, okay, now forget everything you learned. You're now in an environment where you should not pick up a gun to solve your problems, even though that's what we've been teaching you in a war zone like Iraq or Afghanistan. Speaking of numbers, you could also look at the number of police who've been targeted for killings versus police who were killed, you know, in criminal activities. I think what happened in Dallas and Baton Rouge, everybody agrees, is a highly unusual circumstance where it appears that individuals have specifically targeted police and specifically tried to kill police. We don't have all the information yet, and it's possible that that was not the case, but it certainly looks like it on the surface. Again, you could say, well, that's a very small number of people, therefore it doesn't matter. But I think if we do have people targeting the police force, that's a really big problem. Just as it is, if police are more likely to kill black men in interaction than white men or women, it's a problem when there's any kind of prejudice seen in the actions of police with their community. These are all problems that need to be solved, and it's not mutually exclusive. It's not like we have to forgive the police for every killing that happens that they cause, or we have to accept the police getting killed. I think we can work on both problems in parallel. A lot of people are talking about Blue Lives Matter, All Lives Matter. I think the term Black Lives Matter is a little bit of a simplification. I think what it really means to me is Black Lives Should Matter, or Black Lives Matter Too. Because I think the point is that for too long in America, and also in Canada where I live, the lives of people of color, not just black, but Hispanic and in Canada, and probably in the United States, Native peoples, their lives really did not matter. If a Native person in Canada disappeared, the police often showed very little interest. They just assumed that they ended up frozen to death in a snowbank and their body would be found in the river sometime in the spring thaw. And so even when Native women were targeted and killed because people thought they could get away with it, it was true. They were much more likely to get away with it. So it's true that all lives matter, but I think what we need to focus on is that in the past, marginalized groups didn't always matter. But I'd also like to make a criticism of the Canadian version of Black Lives Matter. In Toronto, they were invited to headline the Gay Pride Festival, which I think is reasonable. There is a significant proportion of gay black people involved with Black Lives Matter. So no problem with them leading the parade, but they demanded that the police be excluded from the parade. I mean, this is just wrong on so many levels. And then to compound this, they've made this demand in Ottawa, in Vancouver, in other places. So while we have people who are fighting back against shootings of black people and other marginalized groups, we have Black Lives Matter in Canada arguing about whether there should be a police float at the parade. Now, everybody knows there's going to be police at the parade, so their argument that black people feel bad around the police, that they feel scared around the police, doesn't really carry much weight, because there's going to be police in uniform with guns standing on the side of the parade route. There isn't going to be a big parade without that. And so having a bunch of policemen in feather boas or something like that on a float in a parade, I don't understand how that's more triggering than it is having police on the street corner. But maybe that's not even the most important point. The point is that if Black Lives Matter is going to help reform the police, they've got to work with the police. Maybe some activists think that we can get rid of the police and we can police our streets in some other way. I don't know how that would work, although I see the police have a lot of problems within their ranks, the thin blue line, all that kind of stuff. I don't think we'd be better off without the police. I think we need to reform the police and we need to deal with the bad apples. I think fundamentally the problem with the police is that the police union, the policemen themselves, and a significant portion of the population rally around, and any time a policeman kills somebody, there are a lot of people who say, oh, well, you know, it was a stressful situation and they're really not at fault. I think in many cases the policemen who end up killing have a record of having a short temper, of being violent. And if those people had been kicked out of the police years ago, then they never would have got to the point of killing somebody. So I think taking a position that all policemen do good work and should never be criticized, or taking the opposite position that the police is a totally corrupt institution that just represents the state trying to impose its will on the people, I think both of those extremes are ridiculous. What we need is to take the police, which are doing generally a good job, and to eliminate the small percentage of policemen who are doing a bad job. That will increase the value of the police significantly. It will increase the trust of the community. It will reduce the number of shootings by the police. One of the ironies of Dallas being the site of a shooting of killing of five policemen is that Dallas has actually worked really hard to improve community relations by training their policemen how to de-escalate situations. An article I read, I believe in the Globe and Mail newspaper in Canada, was that citizen complaints had dropped 90% after they had instituted this training. And the number of people killed by the police had also dropped dramatically. So Dallas is an example of where this kind of thing can work. But there's nothing to stop a madman with a high-powered gun from shooting a bunch of people, whoever it is, except by making it very, very difficult to obtain those guns. In most countries, something like an AR-15 would be illegal, and I still don't know of any reason why a normal citizen needs a gun like that. And it may be that 99% of the people who have those guns only use them on the shooting range or for other reasons, and they get enjoyment out of it, but it's only enjoyment. I can't think of any real need that people have for this. They're not really suitable for home defense. They're too powerful. And, you know, there's no reason why shooting ranges can't have that type of gun, but that never leaves the shooting range. Let's go on to Nice, where one disturbed, crazy man killed about 80 people by driving a truck through a crowd celebrating Bastille Day, the biggest national holiday in France, celebrating the freeing of the prisoners in the Bastille at the time of the French Revolution. Everybody jumped onto the fact that this guy was Muslim to say that this was a jihadi attack. It may have been. It doesn't really seem to fit that pattern. This man was not religious. He was not living as a fundamentalist. I've read several times that he must have been radicalized late. I'm skeptical of that. I wonder if he was radicalized at all. There are other reasons for him to do something as horrendous as he did. This crime of just calmly driving a truck through crowds of hundreds of people and crushing people under his wheels. I don't know how, it's hard to get your head around how anybody could do that. But some of the other reasons why he was angry are that just recently his wife had asked for divorce. And one of the reasons why she'd asked for divorce was because he had beaten her. Another reason may have been his jealousy about him living in poverty in a slum neighborhood of Nice, while every day he could see rich people in the cafes, in the hotels, on the beach. And so it may have been jealousy at his lot in life. And it's not just jealousy, because he was probably also aware that in France, the lot of Muslims is to be marginalized. It's hard to get a good job, and it's therefore hard to break out of the ghetto. So France has kind of a circular system because people distrust Muslims. They don't want to give them a good job, and because of that, they work dirty jobs. They see everybody doing better than them. They live in ghettos, and that reinforces the belief that they belong in ghettos, or according to the French National Front, they don't even belong in France at all, even though many of them were born in France and clearly cannot be thrown out of France without completely changing the French Constitution. And there's no country in the world that will accept French citizens who've been thrown out of their own country. As somebody said recently, the place for people who do horrible things is not to be thrown out of the country, but to be thrown in jail. And I think that's appropriate. But there's another possible factor, which is psychiatric drugs. It's been reported, I've read in at least two places, El País, a Spanish newspaper, and also in Newsweek, that he was under psychiatric treatment. That usually means psychiatric drugs such as SSRI, antidepressants, and I hope to have another show on these drugs fairly soon. Now, two side effects of SSRI antidepressants are suicidal ideation, which means thoughts of suicide, which can actually result in suicide. And there are black box warnings on these drugs indicating, at least in certain subgroups, they often talk about teenagers, it can increase the risk of suicide. But a second thing that they can cause is violent or psychotic outbursts. So the question is whether the psychiatric drugs that this man may have been prescribed. I have no information that he was prescribed. I just know he was under psychiatric treatment. But in the modern medical system, what appears to be the cheapest way to deal with people with psychiatric illnesses is to bring them in to see a psychiatrist and then put them on a prescription. Because the only other real alternative is to put them in individual or group therapy, and that's expensive. And so in the short term, it's cheaper to put people on drug therapy. But if some of those people go away and kill their families or do something horrible like this man, it could be that this is actually counterproductive, that society as a whole is bearing the price of the profits of the pharmaceutical industry. I want to emphasize, I don't know that he was on drugs, and even if he was on drugs, I don't know that was the cause. But then I don't know if his divorce was the cause. I don't know if his jealousy at his lot in life, his frustration at feeling like a marginalized Muslim in France, I don't know if those were influences as well. But then nobody really knows at this point whether jihad was an influence. And it's really quite obscene, I think, for France to turn around and to up the ante on the wars that it's involved with, whether that's bombing Libya or Syria or Iraq or Afghanistan. It's going to be perceived by the Muslim world as the West targeting Muslims, that the Christian war on Islam sells really well. I read an article in the Globe and Mail, Canadian newspaper, this weekend by a journalist named Doug Saunders, who said France should go and up the ante in Syria. So I presume that he meant they should drop more bombs, because he says we have to finish off ISIS. Well, first of all, finishing off ISIS is probably impossible. I mean, America went into Iraq with the idea that quickly in 2003 they were going to finish off Saddam Hussein and all the problems in Iraq would be over. Well, it didn't work out. They went into Afghanistan in 2001 to get rid of the Taliban. They're still there, and the problems are still not fixed. They went into Libya. They said, we're not going to stay, but we're just going to overthrow the government. We now have total chaos. There's total chaos in Syria, which is not all the West's fault by any means. Assad bears a big responsibility, and the Russians as well, but it's definitely not helping that everybody's dropping bombs on everybody else. It's not going to result in stabilization and peace. How can there be stabilization when the entire infrastructure of the country has been destroyed? We've created a big hole for ourselves, and every time we drop a bomb, we make the hole a little bit bigger. Finally, let's go to Turkey, where there was an attempted coup. It seemed like people took two sides. Some people said, yay, get rid of Erdogan, who a lot of people don't see as very democratic. And then there were people who were saying, I hate it when liberals support the overthrow of a democratically elected government. Well, there's legitimate debate about whether Erdogan's last election was democratic or whether the system was slanted towards him. But on the other hand, we really don't know whether the coup leaders were truly Democrats or whether we were just going to get a military dictator in place in Turkey. Probably the reason why the coup was a really bad idea, and it was not because it might have worked, but because it might have failed, which it did. And so now Erdogan has the perfect excuse to tighten up his grip on power in Turkey, and he can turn around and target members of the opposition. He can purge his army. He's purging judges. He could become a lot worse because of this attempted coup. So I feel for all the people living in Turkey who may be going through some really bad days in the next little while. I also feel for the people of Nice and France in general. I feel for the police who've been killed in the shootings. I feel for black people who are fearful of the police who are supposed to serve and protect them, but sometimes don't. It would be nice if we could live in a world with more peace and more tranquility. Thank you for listening to The Infectious Myth. I really appreciate you listening to the show. I love hearing from you, whether it's critical or positive. Please send me your comments. Until next week, goodbye.